Welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio. I'm all the way on the other side of the world in Beijing, China. My guest today is Des Bishop. I met Des many years ago when we did shows together in London. He's had a pretty remarkable career. He's originally from New York. He has deep family ties in Ireland. And he moved to Dublin when he was very young, and that's where he started his stand-up comedy career. He's gone on to have a brilliant television career in Ireland. And now, for the past year, he's been living in Beijing because he wants to learn Mandarin Chinese and perform stand-up comedy in Chinese. So I arrived last week, and I went to a local Chinese comedian open mic night that Des is the hosts of, and I couldn't believe it. Here's this guy that I've known for years, and he's standing there in a room full of Chinese people, not only speaking Chinese, but getting laughs in Chinese. The very next day, Des and I went to the Great Wall, and we took this magnificent slide ride that you can take down. We talk about that later in this episode. We also talk about why Des is so in love with China, and modern life here, and the absolute three taboo topics that a performer can never mention while on stage in China. Our shows this past weekend were at a place called The Bookworm. It's a bookstore with a full-service bar in the center of it. And the shows were sold out all weekend. It was promoted as Tom Rhodes in the humor section. That just tickles me endlessly. The audiences were multi-ethnic, multinational, and there's just something about performing in a room surrounded with books all over the walls that inspires you to bring out your best stories and ideas. Des is a great guy. I've known him for years. It's my pleasure to present to you now, all the way from Beijing, China, the one and only Des Bishop. Des Bishop, ladies and gentlemen. Des Bishop.
Oh, thank you. Hey, felt like a round of applause was coming.
I'm going to add that later. You've had such an incredible history. For people who are unfamiliar with you that might have been living in a cave for 20 years.
You mean non-Irish people.
That's it. You're from New York originally.
Yeah, I'm from Flushing, Queens. Grew up there like normally until I was 14. And then through a series of circumstances, I ended up going to boarding school in Ireland when I was 14. But I went on my own. I didn't go with my family. So it was just meant to be like a temporary thing. And yeah, I used to go, you know, like go for a semester, come back for Christmas, Easter, summer. So I was like a New Yorker that was going to boarding school in Ireland. But then I just never left. Went to college, got into comedy, never left.
Okay, and your dad's got Irish roots, so you felt an affinity for the place? And
yeah, I mean, to be honest, my dad is like had an English accent, but thought of himself more as Irish. But he kind of grew up in Ireland, but lived in England most of his life. And then, but my mother, who's American-born, was actually kind of like more the Irish one in a way. Her parents were Irish, and she was really involved in Irish stuff. And like Irish identity was really important in our house, so we were Irish. Like, I always joke in Ireland, it's like, I always thought I was Irish, so I came to Ireland, and then they were like, no, you're not, you're American, you're a Yank. And I was like, what do you mean I'm American? Like, because I don't know about you in Florida, but we didn't think there were Americans. You know, like, America was like a given, but actually you must be something, like, you have to be Irish.
Right, or Italian, or whatever. Yeah, yeah. That's the thing Americans always have, and in Ireland, they always make jokes about it. Americans coming over going, hey, I'm Irish, and they're like, you're not fucking Irish.
Yeah, and I mean, they really knocked that back. But like when we were kids, like if some, you know, we'd ask some kid like, you know, what are you? Like, what's your heritage? And some kid would be like, I'm American. And you're like, what do you mean you're American? There's no such fucking thing as an American. You're fucking Native American. But of course, we didn't say Native American now. We said Indian. So, yeah, I mean, like that was a real, I mean, whatever, man. Me and my Irish identity has just been a real like conflict throughout my whole life. But like, to be honest, that shit used to drive me, when I was a kid, you know, like when I was 14, 15, 16, it fucking used to drive me nuts when Irish kids would be like, you're a fucking Yank, you know, like I used to hate it because like being Irish was important to us when we were kids.
Well, I think it's interesting that instead of like going to London or even after you got really good as a comedian, you really focused on Ireland and chose to be a star there.
Well, actually, that wasn't a decision. What happened was, whatever about my, you know, just like developing as a stand-up, I was developing in Ireland. You know, in terms of my comedy development, if we can indulge, can we
that's what the show is all about.
A bit of comedic nerdery?
That's what the show is all about.
So anyway, as far as my, very quickly, because I was an American, to Irish people, I was straight up just like a guy that got off the plane. And I knew way too much about Ireland for my accent. And I was way too good at doing Irish accents for who people thought I was, which meant that I had great responses from the get-go. And, you know, like, you keep, something's that easy, it's hard not to just indulge in it. And, you know, I got very used to having, like, I guess, stormers, like, early on with, you know, pretty pedestrian material, like, essentially just, like, doing accents and people just going, like, this guy's a genius, you know, like, because they'd never seen an American guy that could do accents. Like, if you've seen Tom Cruise in Far and Away, like, that's what they expect an American to be able to do. So, actually, I had a couple of lands. I went to Edinburgh. I think I did the So You Think You're Funny 2000 or something, and it was just like, I mean, I did fine, but it was just, I was such an open spot. You know, I was doing comedy 3 years at that stage, but I was clearly just an open spot outside of Ireland. You know, like in Ireland, I was already headlining. Outside of Ireland, I was clearly just an open spot. But 2001, 2002, I started to go to Edinburgh. I started doing gigs in the UK, and I really started to like find my Irish pace outside of Ireland. But then in 2003, I got this TV show. And when that TV show went on air in 2004, my life completely changed. And it kind of pulled me back away from, you know, I had already decided that I was going to do more stuff outside of Ireland, but then my kind of Irish success pulled me back. So it wasn't like I decided to be a star in Ireland. It just kind of happened. And then, you know, I just spent, you know, to be honest, I just spent a lot of years riding that wave.
What was the first show in Ireland? That was the working for minimum wage?
Yeah, Des Bishop Work Experience. I didn't insist on having my name in the title. It became that. David O'Doherty actually gave me the idea for the title. And it was based on Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed, which was a book about her living on minimum wage. But she was undercover. You know, like she was, you know, people didn't know that she was writing a book. Whereas we had to have permission from the jobs. And I mean, it was a successful series. You know, some of it was about the difficulties of living low-wage jobs, but I think why it was so successful in Ireland at that time is, obviously, as you know, Ireland was booming at that time, and it was the first time. Irish people were traditionally immigrants. You know, like, you think of Irish people in America, people think of them as immigrants. You know, like, everywhere else in the world, Irish people were immigrants. There were never immigrants in Ireland. So this was the first generation of people who'd experienced foreigners coming to Ireland to work. So most of my colleagues throughout all the jobs were all foreigners. And it was really just me as the outsider talking about what I was experiencing. And then those people, you know, Irish people actually getting a glimpse into these new outsiders' lives. That whole thing coming together just at the right time was just kind of like a perfect storm of why the show like had so much resonance for Irish people.
What was the best thing you got out of working for minimum wage?
The best thing I got out of it, other than like, famous?
Nah. No, I mean the actual experience. No, like, how you related to the people that would do like menial jobs and stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there was a couple of really big incidents. The first thing was that I'm here in China now, all these years later. I'm 11 years after working in Abracababra in Waterford, which was my first job working in a fast food shop. One of my best friends in the world now is Leo, who's back in China, but he was my Chinese colleague. And you know, meeting him was probably the beginning of this journey that brings us into this hotel room right now in Beijing chatting. But, you know, we'll get into that later. But, like, those friendships were one really good thing that I got out of it. I think, secondly, I mean, I don't know if this is something I got out of it, but, like, I had some frustrations. Like, I stopped drinking when I was 19. And from the Abracababra episode, which largely focused on the way that people treat minimum wage workers like shit. Like,
right.
You know, the drunken kebab shop. Like, asshole comes in and, like, they're really racist to those guys. But also just, like, the horror of that time of night, the 2 o'clock. You know, like, your European listeners will kind of know, like, the rush. But you don't get that as much in the States. Like, people just, you know, leave whenever. So you just get this awful rush of just, like, drunken mobs coming at you. And it was kind of nice to get the opportunity to just be, like, just be able to say to everybody, like, come on, like, this is fucking disgusting. You know, like, I love a good time as much as the next guy, but it was awful. You know, like, just one too many freshly eaten, garlic-fried mouths just, like, shouting at you ignorantly. Eventually, you just can't take it anymore. So it was nice to just, to be honest, man, it was just nice to be able to say, like, a couple of things that had been on my mind, you know?
Yeah.
And then nothing. I mean, obviously it gives you a greater appreciation for people's difficulties, but also like we were honest, you know, like I worked in a supermarket and like that job was kind of okay. And like people stick around that job long enough, they get raises. And like, there was people there that made a career. It certainly wasn't a career that I'd be interested in, but at the same time, it's like, you know, you sit down to do these documentaries And like a lot of times people just have like an agenda. They want to just be like, this is awful, isn't it? And they want to make a documentary about how awful it is. And, you know, we were honest. When it was awful. But we were also honest about like the fact that, you know, some of the people working here are just teenagers looking for extra cash. Some of them are Chinese people and they're happy to work 80 hours a week because they don't want a break. Because when they have a day off, they spend money. So they work 80 hours a week. And actually in the end, they end up with loads of money. Like Leo, my buddy, has an apartment in a northeastern city of China with the money he made fucking stuffing drunken people's faces with kebabs. You know what I mean? So like you have to be honest and say like, oh yeah, okay, so I'm a bit of a lefty, but maybe actually, maybe for some people this money is enough and it's worth the torment. For me, I found it a bit of a nightmare, but I thought we were pretty honest, to be honest.
You know, I've been playing in Ireland for years, and the thing that I heard, the special that you did, or series, that I thought sounded like a phenomenal premise, was you took people from the ghetto in Ireland and taught them how to do stand-up comedy. What was that series?
That was called Join the Hood, and that was like...
I worked with Eric Lawler.
Yeah, you know
he went on to be a really good comedian in Ireland.
Yeah, they developed this web series, and now the web series has been picked up by RTE. It's about commuting, and it's literally just this. It's just they put a GoPro in the car, and it's just like these people's drives to work. But it's good. The dialogues and the relationships between the different couples and the different people and their relationships to heading to work has really worked out. So he's one of the couples, you know, like coming in from the suburbs into Dublin, talking about the stresses of, you know, modern Irish life. Anyway, that's Eric. He came out of the Ballymun episode. And that was like, you know, that was like after I did the work experience thing, like, you know, I stopped drinking, stopped using drugs when I was 19, right? And I got heavily involved in like, you know, the life of being a non-drinking, non-drug using person. And which meant that in Dublin, all the guys that I became really close with were all ex-heroin addicts from really bad neighborhoods. And as much as I said that some of my early comedy was just about doing accents, actually a lot of my early comedy was also really inspired by my buddies whose lives had, you know, been really difficult, but they changed their lives. So I knew a lot about that sort of like inner city, gritty existence. And I ended up living with some of them for a while in neighborhoods that Irish people just wouldn't go near. And, you know, those people are funny, man. Like, first of all, they don't give a shit. Like, they're ballsy as fuck. You know, they're fearless in a way. And, you know, just the way that they interact, you know, I guess the way that they keep themselves away from the reality of the situation. I just love that sense of humor. So when I had a chance to make like another TV show, and here's the other thing, it's a comedy podcast. Like one of the annoying things about comedy nowadays is it's like it's a working class form that's been completely hijacked by middle to upper class people, I think. And I'm not saying I'm from the ghetto. Like, you know, I had a good education. I had a lot of opportunities that I shouldn't have had. You know, like I got fucked up on booze and drugs, but my parents kept getting me back into good schools. Like the kids from these neighborhoods, they get one fucking chance. And if they blow it, like that's it. Right. So anyway, I just was like, wanted to fucking just get some fucking working class people on the stage, you know, because it's just like in the end, it's just like everyone having quite similar experiences. And I just wasn't seeing a lot of people like my friends, the guys that I'd grown to get close to on stage. So anyway, one of the guys in that series, Willie White, was actually a buddy of mine before. And the original idea was to do workshops in prison because like a lot of these guys end up in prison. I wanted to do like a comedy workshop in a prison and then follow an ex-prisoner on the outside, right? And without blowing anybody's anonymity, somebody I knew was an ex-prisoner who wanted to do comedy but hadn't done comedy yet. So I pitched the idea to him. He did not want to be the ex-prisoner on the outside. I went to the prisons, long story short, just logistically too difficult. So then I decided, you know what? If we're going to follow somebody on the outside, let's just follow the communities. Let's just go to the communities and put on a comedy show where the humor is from the people that live there and about the area. Because every time you get a series about a bad neighborhood in Ireland and England anyway, and I'm sure it's the same in the States, it's always like intense and it's always like, isn't it awful? Busted out windows. You know, you get a lot of series about like crack dealers in Chicago. And like, I love that stuff. Don't get me wrong. But it's like, yo, these people have fun too, you know? And it's more than just hip hop, you know, like in the States, actually the ghetto has a voice. I mean, it's a limited amount of people that get that voice, but you know, they have a voice through hip hop. Like in Ireland, they don't really have a voice, you know? So I said, fuck it, let's try this. And to be honest, the series was okay, but the experience was incredible. But, you know, each episode was 26 minutes and ended up to me being like an MTV music video of a month, you know, like it took a month of this experience that we had together. These guys did a gig, like life-changing for some of them. You know, I can give you a list of how it changed all these people's lives, right? But in the end, how do you fucking pump that into 26 minutes? So the series was okay, but the experience was like incredible, you know, and doing the gigs, like the gigs were all awesome, except there was one that was tough, but the gigs were all like, you know, you do a gig like in a rough neighborhood, man, like they don't have any experience of sitting in a theater. They don't know etiquette. Right. They don't have a fucking etiquette. You know, like if somebody turned to them and was like, shh, you know, while the comedian's telling the joke, like you gotta
stab you.
You know, they just don't care. And like they give it back. And like, don't get me wrong, I don't like that all the time. Like I'm not a big fan of heckling, but there was just something about that time, the interaction with the crowd. And, you know, it's all local, so people were responding to a lot of the local stuff. The gigs were just like a really amazing experience. Like, you know, it doesn't come across on the TV. Like on the TV, it just looks like a bunch of open spots doing gigs.
I had only heard about it. It sounded like a brilliant premise. I mean, I think that concept would work in the States brilliantly.
Yeah, but I've tried many times, man. I pitched that concept a good few times. The problem is that series, I was able to get that series commissioned because now I had a profile. And I think, you know, if Chris Rock turned around tomorrow and said, you know what, I want to go around to a couple of black neighborhoods. I want to go around to a couple of, you know, like Hispanic neighborhoods. And maybe I want to go to like one or two Indian reservations. That's what I was pitching. Basically, I'm just giving you my pitch, right? If somebody like Chris Rock said they wanted to do that, or another thing that I pitched was, what about the, I won't do it. What about the idea of like famous comedians from these different communities? Like, you know, like a famous Mexican American comedian goes and does it with, you know, people in like the south of Texas. You know, maybe like a collection of different well-known comedians go to different communities and do the thing. But in the end, nobody picked it up. But I do think that would be a great concept. But the only difference is that, like, the difference between Ireland and the States, for example, is, like, there is, like, a black circuit or whatever, like an African-American circuit, if that's a better term. And I do think that, like, guys from bad neighborhoods in New York, say, feel like they have a chance to go to a comedy club and do some comedy. Not to mention, they can actually do comedy in their community. Because there is an African-American circuit. There's Def Comedy Jam. They know that they have access. Now, I know a lot of guys don't do it, but I feel like they know they have access. In Ireland, in those communities, those people would have never thought in a million years that they could do it. Because at the end of the day, it's the same for Willie White, a kid from Ballymun who had an awful life, right? And now he's a successful comedian, just like Eric, right? He had the same chance of going down to the International Comedy Club and asking me for an open spot, you know, because I was running a gig there at the time. But he didn't know. Whereas the kid that's in University College Dublin or Trinity College Dublin, he just knows that opportunity is open to him. So I think it's not a fair. I think maybe in the States it's not as important because I think maybe people feel a little bit more that they could do that, you know?
Right.
But it just wasn't like that in Ireland, certainly. And I knew that from living in those communities and just knowing that people would just never in a million years have the confidence. You know, maybe like they'd start a covers band or something, which is also cool, you know, a way to express yourself. But they would just never know that they could just go down and start busting out some jokes. And of course, there's exceptions to the rule, but I think in the States, there's more exceptions to the rule.
Well, because we all have been polluted with the idea we can all be whatever we want to be in life.
Possibly that's it too, you know, like possibly like Ireland, you know, like certainly before the Celtic Tiger, like people would never think like, well, I can just do it, can't I? Because, you know, whatever, I'm sure I can't speak for working class communities in the States. In fact, you can't even say working class communities in the States. There's such a sort of an illusion about like class. And Americans are obsessed with race, which is right. Kind of funny because I actually think it's class and they've just put race on it. But in America, it's not working class, it's blue collar, you know? So like in Ireland, you know, it's a class issue. in America, it's a fashion issue or something. You know, they're just like afraid to fucking call it what it is, like inequality.
Well, they don't want Americans to wake up and realize that it is a class struggle.
Yeah,
they want everybody to be still worrying about the darker skins and, somebody impregnating your lily white daughter and things.
Yeah, 100%. I mean,
you've got no chance of advancement in the shitty job that you're
still. Yeah, not to mention that if you don't succeed, it's your fault because you've had every opportunity. This is the illusion that they sell to you. If you don't succeed, it's your fault because every opportunity is open to you and you blew it. You know, that's kind of like, I think, I actually love like American enthusiasm, and I think the atmosphere of feeling that you can be whatever you want is actually a positive thing. I think, though, on the flip side is this kind of, I guess, negative byproduct of that message, which is if somehow you don't succeed, that's your fault.
Right.
Like a kind of a complete denial of all the things that are holding people back. And obviously different levels of society have so much more of that holding them back. And then also different levels of society have so much more that's actually allowing them to succeed, but people don't admit that either. And I think stand-up comedy is actually a pretty good example of that. You know, if you look, certainly in, I think in the UK and Ireland especially, I can't speak as much about the US comedy scene, but like, it's just so much easier to succeed as a comedian if, you know, you're in certain universities that, you know, really sort of nurture the arts, and, you know, you just have the time and the money, for example, to start a comedy career without any financial stress because your parents, you know, are supporting you, and, you know, you just, and also you've just grown up in an atmosphere where you feel like having time to explore what you want to do with your life is a valuable thing. Whereas, like, you know, you're not going to be getting that coming out of, you know, like where these guys were coming from, you know, like Ballymun or those different neighbors, and certainly in the States too, like, you know, in a neighborhood where, you know, survival is more important, you're just not going to feel like, you know, I'm just going to spend the next 6 months doing open spots and see what comes out of it. You know, so the, whatever, man. It's a, I don't want to get too, like, I'm not like a super socialist or anything, but you know, you
hammer
me,
and sickle, brother, hammer and sickle.
You asked me about the joy in the hood thing. So that's where all that stuff came from.
It sounded like a brilliant premise. And then you keep making these wonderful specials for Irish television. And then you actually learned how to speak Gaelic and you perform stand-up comedy in the Irish mother tongue.
Yeah. So that's the third series that I made.
Let's hear your opening line.
From the
Gaelic.
My Gaelic show?
Yeah.
You know, the problem is, because, like, I'm in China now learning Chinese. And actually, man, when I try to speak Gaelic now, I speak Chinese. It's like Chinese requires so much of your brain that, like, the Irish was just in the way. It's like Chinese came into my brain. You know, like when a fashion designer, you know, these fashion shows, and like the designer comes into the house and is like, oh my God, there's just way too much stuff here. Like, all this has to go. Like, China just comes into your brain, and Chinese just comes into your brain and just goes like, all right, all this Irish stuff, that's got to go. Like, I'm going to need all this space. So I can't even remember what my opening line was.
Okay. But I mean, it seems, nearly impossible to learn Gaelic and then perform comedy in it. So,
well,
what was the Evel Knievel jump that led to you
wanting to
learning Mandarin and trying to perform comedy in Mandarin? Was that working with your buddy in the kebab shop? Was this idea germinating for?
At this stage, I feel like all my answers have been long winded. I think this is the longest.
this is the place for it.
I think this will probably be the longest to winded one. This is like a typhoon, which is about to hit the Philippines. Well, basically, the Irish series has a lot to do with it, you know, because like.
From learning Gaelic.
Yeah. I mean, just a quick synopsis of why the Irish series made sense. You know, it wasn't just about learning Gaelic and doing comedy in Gaelic. It was about the fact that learning the Irish language is a big issue in Ireland. You know, the same way like healthcare is in the States. I mean, it's not as important an issue as healthcare, but it's as big of an issue as healthcare. It takes up as many dinner party pub chats as healthcare would in the States. You know, like everyone has to learn it. A lot of people hate it. They spend 14 years learning it in school, and then none of them can speak it. A lot of people think it's a useless language. Some people think it's a dead language. So it had a lot of weight, and a lot of Irish comedians, because they all had to do Irish. A lot of them had jokes about the Irish language, and they always worked well. In fact, some people could argue that they're kind of hack, you know? I mean, it's a bullshit term, hack, anyway. You know, good joke is good joke. But anyway, it was very, very easy laughs. So there was just, Irish was so weighted. And I had a genuine desire to learn it just because I was curious about it. I went to school there, but I didn't have to take it. I was just surrounded by this thing, and I was so fucking curious about it. You know, like you pass somebody every day on your way to work, but you never say hello, and eventually you just want to know, who the fuck is this guy? Like the guy selling the newspapers or whatever. Who is this guy? So eventually I said, well, whatever. The concept came about, and after a couple of years, we ended up making the series. And the stand-up part of it, you know, that was just a fun way of just doing the journey. But like on a deeper level, there was this funny thing about language, and this is probably what brought me to wanting to do the Chinese thing, is from learning Irish, even though not a lot of people speak Irish anymore, and from living in an Irish-speaking area, I felt more Irish, you know? And like that's the thing about language that people kind of underestimate, like how much language is part of your identity. Like all of a sudden I had this like new connection to Ireland that I never had before. And I also had an understanding, like I asked this Irish language guy, I was like, do you think there's a difference between the Gaeltacht, where Irish speakers still live, and the rest of Ireland? And he said, well, we speak another language. And I thought, fuck yeah, like what's the difference between France and Spain? Like probably you'd say one of the big differences, they speak a fucking different language, you know? So all of a sudden I was like, holy shit, like that's a major thing. And now I understand that in a deeper sense because I can speak the language. And also it was just good fun for Irish people because they'd all struggled through the language because they were taught so badly. And here was this Yank after 1 year doing a gig in it, you know? Like they learned it for 14 years. They can't even speak it. And I'm like making them laugh in it, you know, with subtitles. And it was just a great way of telling everybody like, hey, maybe there's like another way and that it doesn't have to be this fucking horrible torment for you. So as a result of understanding all that so much deeper from learning the language, I had previously been to China with Leo, who I mentioned before. And like I think you've already experienced from being here, you get blown away by how different China is from what you expect. And you want to tell people, but it's fucking, it's really hard to tell people, you know, you have to come. And so when I had this experience with learning Irish mixed in with a broken engagement, I was engaged to be married and that broke up. And suddenly I had this like open ocean of existence, you know, just like do whatever you want.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, a year in China learning Chinese to do stand up in Chinese would be a great way to show the world what China's really like. Now, it was also, by the way, motivated by the fact that like it had become clear to me that the whole world was interested, some people obsessed, certainly concerned about the rise of China. So I thought, actually, this is a sellable idea. You know, it wasn't just a personal interest about China. I actually thought that people would want to find out and that TV stations would actually be interested in this way of you know, talking about China, which isn't just it's polluted, the government are a bunch of cunts.
Financial markets, yeah, military spending,
exactly,
stuff like that.
Yeah, it's always
all
that
we ever hear, you know?
Yeah, which dehumanizes the people. You know, there's 1.3 billion of them, and we've narrowed them down to like five issues, which actually a good three of them don't even affect their everyday lives that much, you know?
Right, like when I got here the other night when we were talking, I told you the one time I had been to Beijing before, you know, before I came here, I thought they would be like a dour, humorless people. And my impression of Beijing was the average people I encountered on the street were really funny,
yeah,
and silly, and like street vendors had like great senses of humor. And like that was, I wasn't expecting them to be like fun and silly,
yeah,
because of this media news image that you get of China. I thought everybody would be wearing gray and frowns, but you know, they were fun and happy.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. When we started filming the series here, it was just like, we wanted to represent that sort of gray, emotionless face, you know, 1.3 billion people with like no emotions, no engagement, just to say that that stereotype or that impression, which we all have before we come here, it very quickly melts away. And actually the people are really interesting. And like, if China is going to become like the world power that people say it's going to become, and, you know, I think it's pretty important to find out who they are, you know? I mean, I guess in a way we kind of owe it to them. And I think there's a lot to learn. Like, because here's the thing. I mean, this is going to turn in. This is going to just be so luxury. But
let it out. Let it out, brother.
Here's the thing. What I find so interesting about the Chinese, right, is like, so we think, to a degree, we feel like we know what China is. But, like, we totally underestimate how we just are so embedded in us, like, Judeo-Christian values. And just things that we just take as a given, you know, like Christmas and our calendar and, you know, just like basic understandings of religion. Like even if you're an atheist to a degree, like I'm an atheist, but I know that part of my atheism is kind of like, you know, turning away from a God that I know that we all understand. But like for Chinese people, like none of that has anything to do with them. You know, their own religious history is completely different to ours. All their holidays are completely different. And not only that, but like their holidays are based on completely other myths, You know, like I'm here this year and I just never knew about the Mid-Autumn Festival, Qingming Jie, which is about like, your dead ancestors, some other holiday where they all eat this same food because some legend from thousands of years ago killed himself in shame and people didn't want the fish to eat his body. So they all threw food into the river so the fish would eat the food and not this guy. Like wow. that legend, which I've never heard of before, is a national holiday. You know, like it's a day off, you know, and it's like Columbus Day.
Don't eat the dead guy.
Yeah, Columbus Day and President's Day and all these things that are like, you know, embedded in us as part of our culture. Like that's an American one. But, you know, just like all these things that we just take for granted as part of who we are have absolutely nothing to do with these people. You know, their calendar is lunar. Their New Year's is you know, based on the lunar calendar. Christmas means nothing to them. And it's just so great to realize, like, holy shit, despite the fact that the world has become completely globalized and we know everything, on a cultural level, we don't actually know as much. And it's kind of like the next level of understanding, I think, for China. 1.3 billion people, they've been shut off from the world for so long. There's actually quite a lot still to learn. Not traveling around, you know, that's kind of been done. There's not that many places you go in China, I think, where you just feel like, where the fuck am I? You know, I don't think you really get that as much nowadays. You know, there's a Starbucks in all the big cities, but even in the small cities, there's just about enough where you can still feel like, you know, you're not lost. But culturally, once you sort of take that journey into actually like people's lives, you realize that like, holy shit, we've got so much like to understand. And I think learn from them. And certainly there's plenty that they can learn from us. Like, you know, so I think, that's inspiring, like to be in the middle of that. But actually in terms of like what we're trying to achieve, which is like tell a story about China and using my journey of learning Chinese to do stand up in Chinese, what happens is you spend 6 months here and then suddenly you get overwhelmed with the fact that like, there's no fucking way I'm going to understand what I want to understand in that short space of time, because it's actually so much greater, you know, thousands of years of their history and their culture and, you know, the civilization and just the way that they've come to be, you know, like even just like the fact that like whether you're religious or not, so much of our value system comes from religion, you know, like what we think is right and wrong. Like for them, largely it comes from Confucius, you know, like so much of what they believe in. And it's very different, you know, loyalty to family and, you know, like honor and, you know, respect for elders. And, you know, like all that stuff comes from kind of a different value system, you know, and it's really interesting to see that their society has evolved in a completely different way. I mean, to a degree, it's ended up in a similar space, but, you know, it's evolved in a different way. And like, you know, if I sound like I don't know what I'm talking about right now, it's because I don't. It's because I've only just begun to understand that actually I've so much to learn. And that is fucking cool when you're just like, realize you've got a lot. You know, it's kind of exciting to know that there's all that still to discover.
What should the rest of the world know about China?
Well, for starters, the rest of the world should know. How do you answer that one quickly? What should the rest of the world know about China?
You know,
firstly, they're more fun. They're much more fun than you think.
Right.
Right? Their sense of humor is not like as different as people think. Like, you know, there's like, do they have a sense of humor? You know,
what do they make jokes about? Like, we went to the Great Wall and I was getting you to ask the taxi driver. And so I'm asking you, you know, cause okay, you're,
well, they're puns. They're big into puns. Like China is like the pun capital of the world because their language is tonal. So I'm sure you've heard before, but like ma, 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 ma are four different words, right? Based on the tones. Ma, 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 right? So there's four different words. So there's just so many plays on words. And not only that, but like ma, you know, like the first tone for ma is not even just one word. There's probably like four different words that use the first tone for ma. But the characters are different. And they just know in context which ma you're talking about. So they just love plays on words. Like, you know, like the joke that guy told us on the slide down is just a basic joke. So Nali means where. So like if I wanted to ask you, where are you from? I'd say, you know, Nisha Nali Ren. You are what person, right? You are where person. That's how that translates. Nali means where. But when somebody gives you a compliment, you say Nali, Nali, which kind of just means like, no, come on, don't flatter me, don't flatter me. You know, it's just a way of being modest, and modesty is really important here. So that joke was basically just a joke about an American, you know, some Wago Ren at a house, you know, and he compliments somebody, and the person keeps going, Nali, Nali, and the American is just like, why does he keep saying where? You know, like, they just love, you know, like, the double meanings on words. I'm not saying
it's
that's
silly.
A good,
it's yeah. silly. You're right, right, right. It's not, yeah, it's not brilliant intellectual stuff, but it's silly.
So much. You go on.
I thought it was amazing. I arrived here two nights ago, and I go straight to this open mic night that you put on. And it's all Chinese comedians doing Chinese language, and you hosted it, and you thought, after the show, you were like, yeah, I didn't do that good. And I'm like, Des, you performed in Chinese, for God's sakes. I mean, I was absolutely blown away that you can get on stage and do comedy in Chinese.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, to be honest, a month ago, I was at that, like, just, I couldn't fucking believe it sort of thing, you know? But, you know, it's a character flaw, to be honest. Like, I'm never fucking pleased.
That's a comedian thing. Right.
You know, so, like, there I am. I'm 9 months. Like, yesterday I'm learning Chinese for 9 months. And after 9 months, I'm up there. Like, I organized that gig as well, right? So I'm up there hosting this show in Chinese. And I've already got to the stage after 9 months of learning Chinese that when I'm not like killing in a language I can hardly speak, you know, when I haven't figured out a way to absolutely rip it with 1,200 words, I'm already turning to you, like my comedian colleague, and going like, man, I don't know, man. It was only all right. But, you know,
I couldn't believe it. I'm sitting there beaming with pride because I know you.
I know, but the problem was that 2 weeks before was the first one, and I actually...
You killed it.
Well, no, I didn't kill it, but I have 7 minutes. I genuinely have... 3 bits, and I've done them a couple of times to the point where, like, I know the laughing point. They call a punchline a laughing point. Oh, it's wow. Very funny when they translate. It's like, yes, you need to understand the Chinese laughing point. So anyway, I know the laughing points of my 3 bits, and I kind of know that they work in the way that I did, like, in the early stage of my comedy career, my early bits. And you seeing me for the first time, it's like I'm actually doing bits that I just started doing. So I know you didn't understand anyway, but, you know, like, I just had wished that you had been there for, like, the 2 weeks before where it was killing. But, you know, yesterday, in a way, I was actually talking to one of the comedians yesterday night, or two nights ago at the gig, sorry, was almost better in a way, because after that first bit sort of, I thought the first bit was kind of a disaster. I then just, like, fucked around with the audience, and that was cool, more just for the fact that, like, I was just enjoying the fact that I'm now doing crowd work, like, in Chinese with Chinese people and, you know, like, where are you from stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, like that.
No, and then going around the city with you and the fact that you have got enough of a grasp of the language where you're talking to everybody and surprising people.
Yeah, and not letting that fucking asshole taxi driver.
Right, the taxi driver tried to screw us.
Big time, took us the long way. And
you called him on the shit. He thought he had two dumb white guys in the back, and he only had one dumb white guy.
He had two dumb white guys. One of them happened to be able to speak Chinese. But anyway, yeah, it's cool. It's really cool. But on the flip side, in terms of the TV show that we're making, I actually feel like, I don't know if anyone's going to be, I actually think to a degree that a lot of what I'm experiencing now is, like, only fun. You know, like, it's only fun for people that have experienced it. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to translate. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to use the story of what I've been experiencing over here to tell a story of China that's both entertaining and informative to Western people, you know, like, to people in the West that are going to watch this. And that's a challenge that I don't have to tackle on my own, thank God. You know, myself and my director can tackle it. But, you know, it's great that you're here with me and we're having fun, and you can see, you know, I can actually use you as a mirror for seeing, like, what I've experienced so far, and that's great. But at the same time, you know, I do think that why it's really interesting to you is because you're here experiencing it with me, and I'm just not exactly sure if I'm going to
Well, but I'm interested in worldwide comedy. And then, like I said, my first impression of Beijing was, wow, the regular people have got a great sense of humor. Now, the other night, I'm watching all these comedians perform in Chinese, and you know, you were standing back by me, and the one guy was on stage, and you go, "Oh, he's doing a dirty joke right now. That's totally, that's not cool. So, like, you told me the comedians here, like, never use dirty material?
Yeah, I mean, it's hugely conservative in that regard. You know, the,
especially because a lot of open mic nights in the States, it's like a lot of people do dirty stuff out, because it's an easy laugh.
Yeah, it's like, so I pulled a knife out of my girlfriend's cunt. It's like, oh, shock.
Right. But so you're telling me the average Chinese person it doesn't like.
Well, here's the dirty opposite. Humor. Here's the opposite. That guy that you saw doing that has been doing comedy over 10 years, and he's the most experienced, and he was by far the best that night. And it's only through his experience that he's the only one with the confidence to give it a shot. The exact opposite. Here, the open spots would never in a million years try that. But the thing is that Beito Tokozo, the guys, they're more like a society than a comedy club. That comedy society, they're these pioneers who have started doing Western style stand-up.
They've all got jackets with their name on it?
Yeah, but those guys that have like t-shirts with their name on it, it's not even a joke. They have t-shirts. And most of, I actually told them, you guys got to stop wearing the t-shirts. They're all wearing the same t-shirts. I was like, comedy is not like a uniform thing. You got to fucking find
it's
your
an expression of individuality.
Yeah. You got to find your identity, man. You know, like, so anyway, they have a set of rules. And on one of those rules is that, you know, like if it's too racy, it's not cool, because basically they're concerned about how that would reflect upon them, the Beito Tokozo society. So, you know, and there's
the
just
talk show society.
Yeah. Well, they translate. I mean, God, this podcast is gonna be like 5 hours.
But so it's more of a cultural restriction to not talk dirty. It's not like a government.
Oh, it's
thing.
Totally a cultural restriction. And the thing that I'm trying to get across to them, like, here's what I think. I think stand-up comedy in China is like Lenny Bruce's time. Like I was saying to them, I wasn't saying to one of them, you need to be the Chinese Lenny Bruce. But what I was saying was, okay, let's accept something. Comedy, stand-up comedy as we know it, is famous for pushing boundaries. So there are certain boundaries that you know you're not going to be able to push. You're not going to be able to push criticism of the government because it's going to get you in major trouble. And that's like real trouble. That's not like the trouble you might have in the States. Like, you know, it's like you could be imprisoned, and that's like a real presence, right? And it's a fear with a comedy form that's so free, like stand-up comedy. So we know that we can't talk about that, fine. But there are things that you can push that aren't going to get you in trouble. They might offend some people in the audience, but it might also win you some fans. You know, you could champion the cause for saying to society, we all have sex. Actually, there's so much interesting stuff about Chinese relationships. The pressure for marriage, they're under pressure to get married so much older. There's much more economic pressure around marriage. There's much more, you know, like economic conditions around who you'll marry. There's, you know, there's a lot less class movement in China. There's a hell of a lot of extramarital affairs. There's loads of fucking interesting stuff that's going on in human sexual relationships that you can tackle. And what's even more exciting about it is, you don't even have to just tackle it in the sense that you're the first guy that does dirty jokes we were doing in 1975 in the United States. No, you can actually be the first people to tackle uniquely Chinese challenges in the bedroom, in the house, you know. And also another thing that they don't really tackle at all is like the very difficult relationship between children and parents, because, you know, like respecting your parents is much more important here than it is in the States, right? Or it is in the West. So like all these things are there for them to tackle, you know. And they're really afraid to do so because they're convinced that to offend is to be defeated. You know, like offense is a loss. Shibaila. Like I've experienced defeat because I've offended. And what they don't understand is, like, you know, through sort of trying to find that line, they might actually open themselves up to like something really interesting. And I told them that there's comedy forms that Chinese people are very familiar with. It's not stand-up comedy. They have their own tradition of comedy. You know, it's called Shansheng and it's called Arunzhuang, and it's usually two-hander stuff.
It's two guys, right? And one's a smart one and the other one's like dumb and fat.
It's basically Abbott and Costello. Everyone uses that example. And it's hugely popular here and people are very familiar with that form.
But wouldn't they get tiresome after a while?
But this is the thing. It's so tiresome. And what I told them was, you know, you have the opportunity to be something completely different. But here's the unfortunate thing for you guys. Nobody has done it before you. So in fairness to them, it's hugely brave for them to be those guys that can do it. But I told them, I was like, tackle the areas that you can tackle. And like I use the example of sexual relationships because it's one, and I use the other example of like relationships and families as another. I'm sure there's one or two others that don't spring to mind right now. I mean, I think actually like the economy is probably just on the line. Like I think there's enough going on about the economy that you could talk about without getting into like criticizing the government. But like China has experienced this, you know, 1978, Deng Xiaoping opens up the Chinese economy, and like, it's been revolutionized. Like Chinese property prices in Beijing have changed. They're 10 times more than they were 10 years ago. 10 years ago. And now a property is 10 times more expensive, right? So like, it's a massive social change. And I think there's enough, without getting into trouble, within that massive social change that they can begin to tackle. And I think they are starting a little bit, but I also think that they are, like, there's another Western guy called Jesse Appel, and he's fluent, like, and he's already doing stand-up fluently in Chinese. And we chat a lot about this, that like, The guy, he wasn't there last night, but I know a guy that's already doing it. But the guys in that group that decide, fuck it, I'm going to take the risk. I'm going to blow the room a couple of times. I'm going to get some walkouts. And I'm not talking about them being shock comics. I'm talking about them talking about shit that would be so fucking tame for us. We'd probably walk out of the room in boredom, not in offense, right? You know, like the guys that have the courage to do that, I think are going to be the guys that are going to blow up. And I think there's a generation of people in China that are ready for that, you know? And, you know, there's another thing, which is Huang Shijiu Wang has come back, and, you know, he's actually going to make Chinese people, I think, he's already famous. I think he's actually going to make Chinese people a little more familiar with the form, too. So I think these guys are, you know, I think these guys are at the forefront of something.
You're at the forefront of a new massive
comedy. Well, we're comedians. We're comedians in an industry that's very mature and established. But I really feel... And of course, because I'm in this industry, this might be like a biased opinion, but I actually feel like China needs stand-up really bad, you know, because there's just too much happening in this society, not for people to have the tool, you know, like I think stand-up is a good tool for dealing with life, you know, like, you know, making sense of it, you know, and I think it's more important here than what we do back at home, you know, making people laugh is fine, but here I think they can do something really interesting.
Well, and all this massive runaway wealth that's happening. I mean, not everybody's going to get totally rich, so.
Yeah, well, inequality is much greater here than at
right.
home.
Right, so I mean, making fun of those people is all poor people have, you know, that's.
Yeah, well, there's one actually, like, if you looked at it, you would see, it's in Chinese, but you would very clearly see that it's a straight sketch show format, much more like what we would be familiar with. That's just online, it's not on TV. But the guy is hugely famous now. I can't even remember the name of the show, but I watched it. Like, some of the sketches are funny. Like, I don't understand the Chinese, but you can see, like, they're funny. I mean, they're basically just, like, setups and reveals, but they're really funny. And I have to say, like, largely his targets are the nouveau riche of China. And they are eating it up. Like, the Chinese are all over it. You know, they're aware of how much China has changed, and they're into watching this guy kind of make fun of it. They're less into... More traditional forms of Chinese comedy are much better at sort of like making fun of like the issues of like the poor or just like the masses. And that actually, there's some old school comedians that, like, you know, it's probably a bit hackneyed now, but I actually think they've done a pretty good job of, you know, talking about all that stuff. But, you know, the more like stuff that we're more familiar with, they definitely tend to sort of tackle, you know, the nouveau riche and just the quick changes in China. And they've got a lot of nicknames for, you know, basically people that have come into a lot of money and, you know, are a bit tacky. And, you know, Chinese people are super tacky, man. Like I'm not familiar enough with Chinese culture to really start cracking at them, you know, but there's like a lot of ridiculousness in China that when my Chinese is good enough, I'm going to attempt. But there's huge issues with Western people making fun of China. They're not completely open to that, like, just yet. But I think that these Chinese comedians, they've got big targets, man. There's ridiculous gaudiness here.
Yeah, you see like a yellow Ferrari passing some old person pulling, you know, like a wagon full of scrap metal.
So. Yeah, I mean their taste is completely different anyway, but they're definitely at a phase. Like they've developed so fast. Like as a society, like they're very showy offy, you know, and there's more respect for the showy offiness here in that, like, if you met some guy that you grew up with that came into some cash and he was just like being really brash and like talking a lot about his successes and his ridiculous car and, you know, like his Gucci crap or whatever, everybody would be like, what a dick. But actually here, people are just like, wow, that guy has done really well. You know, so it's quite interesting because
there's something to aspire to.
Yeah, they're into it. You know, it's very different. You know, like here, I'm always introduced as a really famous comedian from Ireland. Like that's how they introduced me. You know, Natasha Henyo Ming, the Irelander, Chuchura. You know, like they just get right into it. Like, this guy's really famous, and then they want to know. And then like you show them like your website, and they're just like, wow, you're really, you know, like there's no modesty at all. Like my family are so into the fact that I'm like famous in Ireland. I'm like, yo, Ireland has 4 million people. Hai Dien Chu, which is my neighborhood in Beijing, probably has the same population. Wow. So it's like I'm famous in fucking Flushing. You know, like I'm the equivalent in China of being famous in like, you know, five stops on the subway kind of a thing.
As a comedian, what are the government restrictions and absolute taboo topics you could never go near here?
Well, there are many. The one thing, I'll just give you an example in terms of like censorship and how it works. If you were to do a show in a big venue, like our shows are small, they're under the radar. We don't have a permit. You're supposed to have a permit to perform, right? So none of us get those permits. Like the show you're doing tonight is illegal. Officially, it's illegal, right? The fact that I'm paying you is illegal. The fact that we sell tickets is illegal. The fact that we have gathered a group of people to listen to a performance is illegal. We're supposed to apply for a permit to the Cultural Bureau. We're supposed to go to the Cultural Bureau and apply for a permit. And to receive that permit, you have to submit a written script of the performance, and then they have to say yay or nay. And usually in that yay or nay, there will be some amendments. There will be some highlighted bits. The green fluorescent pen will have been out as saying this is unacceptable and this is unacceptable. So if I say, for example, my Chinese was good enough in a year, say, and I had a bit of a following on Weibo, and I decided I wanted to book a 350-seat venue in the center of Beijing, I would have to submit my script and wait for the...
Your entire show would have to be...
My entire show. Now, my understanding is once you get the permission and you start the show, there's nobody sitting there, like, ticking off the bits, I understand, you know. However, you still wouldn't be able to turn around and be like, well, let me tell you something about Xi Jinping and all his, you know, his supposed reforms. You know, at the end of the day, like, for example, like, if you wanted to just like call a spade a spade, like listen, at the end of the day, right, all the money has gone to the leaders of the Communist Party. They have a ridiculous amount of wealth. They are the children of a revolution that was supposed to be about the people. And now China is probably the least communist society on the planet. Like the funny thing is that China is so capitalist, like it's so dirty capitalist, that it makes America seem socialist. You know, like
right.
Their healthcare is worse than the States, right? So it's so unequal, right? If you turned around and said that, like you would just be in jail, you know, even though pretty much everybody knows that the children, you know, like Xi Jinping is now the leader of China. He's a child of one of Mao's cronies, right? The revolutionary leaders from 1949, their children are now all the head honchos, and all the people that inherited the revolution have ridiculous wealth, ridiculous power, and ridiculous influence, right? So China is a completely unequal society. But you just can't go near any of that.
It's stuff. Never addressed.
Never addressed. Western media talk about it, no problem. Chinese intellectuals talk about it when they can, you know, in a safe environment. But some of them get in trouble. And anyone who decides that they really want to actually lead a campaign for, like, a movement for reform... Like, not even a movement for democracy, but just a movement for reform, like a movement for some equality, or even like a movement for some goddamn accountability, you're shut down. Mm. So instead, what you get are these show trials, like, well, Bo Xilai is probably a kind of an exaggerated example, but like Bo Xilai would be a trial that a lot of people are familiar with. That was the guy whose wife got convicted of
murder,
organizing murder, yeah. And then he got convicted for embezzlement and all sorts of money. Like, so they have a couple of big trials like him and a few others where they say we're tackling corruption. But it's like, how can you, like, because we have a Western open mind and we're allowed to let the critical part of our brain say, come on, like, we're not fucking stupid, right? How can you turn around where you have Xi Jinping and Hu Jintao and all, Wen Jiabo, all these guys that were previous leaders of China and the current leaders of China, they have ridiculous wealth, right? Where did you get that wealth? Where did that wealth come from? You're the children of the revolution. How did you end up with all the wealth, right? So Bo Xilai is corrupt, but you guys aren't corrupt. You have the same amount of money and the same amount of houses and cars and power that Bo Xilai had. Of course you're corrupt too. Of course, right? But you just, it's so obvious that it has to be that you can't say anything, because if you were allowed to say something, the fucking house of cards would crumble so fast. So the Communist Party have these pretend reforms. It keeps people, it doesn't even keep people, I think most people are just kind of cynical about it nowadays. But also, the propaganda is good enough, you know, the media is controlled enough that, like, I'll give an example. Like, you watch the Chinese news, right? The Chinese news is three parts. Every single day, I challenge you, tonight at 7, if you have a chance, turn on the news is at 7, okay? CCTV 1. Turn on the news. Guarantee you the first story is about Xi Jinping. Every single day, the first thing I hear is, blah, 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 Xi Jinping, right?
The president.
Yeah, so this is the news. The government are amazing. 10 minutes. Lao Baixing, the everyday people of China, are absolutely delighted with everything. And the third section is, the West is a fucking mess. And I guarantee you to watch the news for 2 days in a row, and it will follow that format. I mean, I do not say that lightly. That's the format. So it'll be like Xi Jinping, you know, and the news bits are so long, and he's shaking hands. Right? Then the second bit will just be like a circus in some fucking small province, and a load of poor people just thinking it's great fun, right? And then the third bit will be like fucking, you know, like a mall shooting in the States, or like people burning American flags in Iran, or it'll always just be something like fucking nuts. Like, thank God we live in China, because you want to be part of this fucking mess over there, man. You know, it's like, you know, like our society is absolutely crazy, but look at these guys, you know? So anyway, there's just so much like that type of stuff that you can't super tackle. Like, but the crowds in China like a sneaky government joke every now and then. I have one sneaky government joke in the 7 minute. You didn't see it, but I got one sneaky government joke in there. And they like a sneaky government joke. But if this comedy scene ever got a bit bigger, it would have to get really safe really fast. You know, if you want to be gutsy, it's not going to be talking about the Chinese government. It's, you know, and like, whatever, man, I could bore you about Guanxi and how human, you know, relationships here are really, really important. And like, it's not just about criticizing the government. It's like, say you turned around and like had a crack at the newscaster, like even if you could do his voice, like say you turned around and did an imitation of the newscaster, right? But say he finds out, right? But it turns out he's actually the second cousin of somebody really important in the government. He turns to the second cousin and says, you see, this fucking asshole was on CCTV last night. He's doing my fucking accent, right? So then that guy doesn't want to lose face, right, with his cousin, so he has to take action on it. It's like essential. Mm. He doesn't want to lose face, because Mienza, face here, is like super important. It's everything. Face is everything, right? So he has to do something about it, right? So then it doesn't even go to the high level of government. He could just be some local government official. But then he just basically says to the cops, you got to go and shut down that comedy club that these guys are running, and then that's it. You spend 6 months trying to get the thing back open. And it happens all the time. Mm.
You told me yesterday when we were going to the Great Wall that there's the three T's that you can't talk about.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's a guarantee. We have a government guy that follows us around when we're filming, but he's actually pretty comfortable with what we're doing, so he doesn't follow us around anymore. But we were explicitly told that whatever you do, you cannot talk about the three T's: Tibet, Taiwan, Tiananmen, right? Tiananmen doesn't even exist here. Like, it's been completely washed. You can't find a picture of the Tiananmen massacre in 1989 anywhere on the internet here. You have to use you have to go around the firewall to even see it, right? So those three things you can't talk about. You're not allowed to film in Tiananmen either. But here's China. All these regulations, our government guy was like, you're not supposed to film in Tiananmen. Please don't film there. But if you're going to film, use a camera that looks like you're just taking pictures. So they kind of like, they get it, you know, like they don't really care if you film in Tiananmen, if you're just doing a bit in Tiananmen. What they do care is if you sit there and say, I'm in Tiananmen, this is where a load of kids were gunned down in 1989, that's a problem.
Right.
But of course, the thing is, they weren't gunned down in Tiananmen, they were gunned down near Tiananmen. They were actually gunned down trying to get there or trying to leave, you know, which is just goes to show you that, like, actually, even what we know in the West is skewed by the fact that a story is told and then everyone locks the story into their head, but actually sometimes the story is not exactly what you thought it was. You know, it's just like, you know, like Chinese whispers, coincidentally enough, like Chinese whispers. So yeah, Tibet, forget it. Because the West is obsessed with Tibet. You know, like the West, it's just like a big fan of Tibet, and I would be the same. And, you know, we like the Dalai Lama. Like, I love the Dalai. I think the Dalai Lama is a very interesting character. And a lot of us have seen Kundun, and we would have resentments against China for the way they treat Tibet. And I think they're very valid, you know, and I think it's like a modern version of what England did to Ireland to a degree, you know, so much so that actually the Tibetan language is now under pressure because they're making all the kids do Chinese in school. That is an awful thing that China do, and that China has done. And, you know, if I talked about that and was seen talking about it, our documentary would get shut down. But then on the flip side, like, anything you say in English isn't really that big of a deal. But like, if you started talking about it in Chinese, forget it. I mean, they're super, super sensitive about that. It's like, you can't even go to Tibet as a tourist unless you're with an official guide. The only way you can go to Tibet and just have free reign is if a Tibetan family invites you, and they have to apply for that permit. So like, Tibet is heavily, heavily controlled because, you know, like, it has to be, because it's awful what they're doing there, you know, and their claim on Tibet is loose, you know, it's a loose claim. I mean, there's historical aspects of why China makes a claim to Tibet. I get that. But I mean, it's so clearly another culture and so clearly, you know, a different place in so many ways. The fact that at certain times in Chinese dynastic history, they had a claim over Tibet does not change the fact that the way they took over Tibet, like the way they decided to say Tibet was China after the revolution, was a new invasion. You know, it was the next phase of China invading Tibet, as opposed to China saying Tibet was always China, if you get what I mean.
Right.
So that's a sensitive one. Because, I mean, basically, I don't know if it's a fair comparison, but, you know, like, the genocide of the Native American happened when the world's media was not watching. But if that was happening today, not only would America be a pariah, but there would just, it just wouldn't be allowed to happen. It would quickly be, you know, said that this is unheard of. And, you know, to a lesser degree, but not completely unlike that, you know, a little bit like that is happening in Tibet. You know, I mean, it's not as much of a massacre, but it's, you know, they're kind of destroying a culture, and they're like, they're just doing, yeah, it's not great what they're doing. But the difference is that the world's media is watching. So China are heavily, heavily sensitive about it, because if too many people really knew what was going on in Tibet, they probably wouldn't be as supportive.
Right.
But like, if you ask a Chinese person, you say like, you know, like, why do you hate the Dalai Lama? What about Tibet? Like, some Chinese people will say, would you cut off your thumb and not be upset about it? In other words, why would we allow our thumb to be cut off? Tibet is part of China.
Mm.
You know, that's the way they perceive it. So for them, it's just like, why do you Western people care so much about Tibet? It's China. It's none of your business. And Dalai Lama is a terrorist.
Wow.
Like, that's, you know,
right.
It would be like the same as like saying to an Israeli in like 1982, like, why do you guys hate Yasser Arafat so much? At the end of the day, he's just trying to like get a bit of space for his people, you know? They would be horrified that you could even see, like, even, you know, and I understand both points of view. I understand, you know, why people would be sympathetic to the PLO at that time. But I also understand how Israeli people see it completely differently, because their perception of it is a completely different experience.
Okay, let's move on to happier things. thank you. Yesterday, you took me to the Great Wall of China.
Yes, and for the second time in your life.
That was the second time in my life. And I had to go back to the one section. There's three sections where you can visit the Great Wall. And there's only the one section that has the big toboggan, like, luge slide where you go down. And we did that. And I have to say, as impressive as the Great Wall of China is, I'm even more impressed with that fabulous slide that goes down.
Yeah, for me, it's like basically somebody deciding that for their whole life they need to go to the United States. And as part of that trip, they need to go to Washington, D.C., to ride a roller coaster. That's basically like,
no, what it'd be like if you went to the White House and like, you was like this icon that you've wanted to see your whole life, and then the tour's over, and then you exit the back door, and then there's like a big massive water slide that ends into a pool or something.
Yeah, like, I mean, it was great. It was just great. But for me, it was just like amazing how much the slide was part of what you wanted to do. And that, like, I was like, we go to the Great Wall.
I wanted to pay and go up and do it again, but it was the end of the day.
At the end, I know. But it makes it great fun, you know? And the Great Wall's great. It's great to see it, and it's beautiful. But, you know, for me, I don't know, man. Like, the Great Wall to me is just, like, one of those tourist attractions that, like, is amazing, but at the same time is a little bit sort of underwhelming. You know, it's great to
be there. I don't know. It was pretty amazing. The first time I went, I was blown away. It's one of those things on the checklist of life when you're, like, a little kid.
Yeah, it is.
I want to see this. I want to see this before I die. And then to go back a second time, and I had ridden that slide the first time. I didn't know it was there. So, I mean, I wanted to go back to the Great Wall, but I have to admit, it was more about that going down that slide.
Well, I was happy, too, because the last time I went to that particular Great Wall, there was a really slow person on the toboggan in front of me. So I was glad to get a good go at it, man.
Well, that's good, too, because you speak Chinese, and we had made our game plan, and you told the guy, look, we're going to let those people go, give them some space so they're finished.
To be honest, I didn't even finish the sentence. I was like, yo, we're going to wait. And he was like, of course you're going to wait. You want to go fast, right? Like, that's what he was like. He's like, you want to go fast. I get it. Come on. I get it. You want to go fast. You know, and which actually comforted me because I was like, yeah, fuck that, man. We're going to rip down that shit.
And we ripped down it. I was ripping down it. And then you get down at the end and it gets a little more intense with the drops and the curves. And then there's some guys, Chinese guys, yelling at you to slow down. Because obviously they've had some people flip over the sides because, you know, safety probably isn't as restrictive as
health and safety is not an issue here.
No, I mean, these people,
I mean, even the fact that
they don't care what they put in baby milk. You think they give a fuck about me?
That's a good line, man. Write that down. You gonna try that tonight?
I'm gonna do that tonight.
Yeah, man. I mean, health and safety.
Didn't say tea.
You didn't say tea.
Any of the teas.
But thank you. I don't care. You
I can make fun of the baby milk.
Yeah, right? You can be Mr. fucking T tonight. I don't give a shit. I'll fucking say what I want. I'll say what I want, fool. I'm Mr. T. You can fucking drop him, man. I don't give a shit.
I'm excited. So we got the shows tonight in Beijing, tonight and tomorrow. And I'm thrilled to be here, Dez. So let me ask you a few questions before we wrap this up. What is the greatest advice you've ever been given as a comedian?
Oh, the greatest advice, which wasn't given directly to me, but actually somebody told me it was the best advice they'd ever seen written, and I have taken it on. It was actually originally written by Johnny Vegas, which was persistence without expectation is the best way to approach a stand-up comedy career.
Wow. Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah, persistence without expectation, which to me is another quote actually that comes from like the not drinking world is expectation is just premeditated resentment, which I put those two together just in terms of like, you know, like whatever, just do your best, but at the same time, just be happy with the results, you know? So, persistence without expectation, because, you know, of course in the comedy world, so many people just focus so much on all the things that they haven't got, thinking that somehow, they deserve it, which, you know, sometimes might be true. But if you look at that persistence without expectation and just, then the journey becomes the important thing, not the destination. I think it can keep you happier because this can be a tough game at times, like emotionally. So,
yeah,
I think that's that answer.
Well, I've always had a lot of respect for you since we've known each other. I'm really
since the snapping days.
Since the snapping days when I used to pop my
before your snap got debilitated.
I'm really excited to be doing the show with you in Beijing this weekend. I mean, we played together in England, Ireland, Amsterdam.
Yeah, probably England, Ireland, Amsterdam. Never in the States, though.
No,
I haven't performed much. Oh, cool. Well, that's great. I'm glad you came to Beijing, man.
In closing, do you have any words of wisdom or advice for the people of the earth?
Oh, advice for the people of the earth? Don't be afraid to love yourself, but don't talk about it that much. I don't have any ones that I normally say, but...
That's perfect.
Thanks.
All right, brother. Thanks, Dez. Long may you run, brother.
Tom Rhodes, you're a funny man. Tom Rhodes, you're an international comedian. Tom Rhodes, karate kick, baby, oh yeah. Tom Rhodes, you're a groovy dude. You go all around the world telling jokes to all of the people. You are an international comedian. You're funny to everybody in every single country in the world. Tom Rhodes, I like you very much. I think you're talented and very wonderful. Tom Rhodes, you're the best guy in the world. I wanna be your friend, you should call me sometime. Here is my phone number, 603-644-0048. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tom Rhodes, you're an international comedic sensation. Tom Rhodes, I like to listen to your podcast. Tom Rhodes, you're the best man to ever walk on the earth.